about her latest story collection, Pure Hollywood. And at 11:30, Black Book Talk co-hosts Emma Jackson Ford, O. Bill Hill, and Patricia Welch discuss what's on their bookshelves this month. Listeners are invited to call in and share their current reads. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Challenging the Both Sides Narrative, Difference Between Fascist and Antifa Movements in the Trump Era, on Thursday, April 4th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Cider Riot in Portland. Challenging the Both Sides Narrative is a talk by Dr. Stanislav Vysotsky. This talk will provide an overview of contemporary fascist and anti-fascist movements with a focus on the key differences between them. Again, that's Challenging the Both Sides Narrative, Difference Between Fascist and Antifa Movements in the Trump Era, on Thursday, April 4th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The Heather McCoy Show.
And welcome to the Heather McCoy Show on KBOO in Portland. On Friday, March 22nd, the iconic musician Scott Walker passed away at the age of 76. His career started as a teen heartthrob in the 1960s as a member of the Walker Brothers, and later as a solo artist, his work moved to the avant-garde. Here to discuss his life and work is Stephen Kayak, the director of Scott Walker, 30th Century Man, which was released in 2006. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Hey, thank you, Heather. Good to be here.
Oh, it's nice of you to join us. As a personal anecdote, I find that most Scott Walker fans remember who introduced him to them and where they were, what they were doing when they had first encountered that baritone voice with the accompanying composition. As somebody who admires his work as well, do you find that his fans can paint a scene as vivid as a Scott Walker song when they recall to you the first time they've heard his work?
You know, I don't really have a lot of those stories that I've heard from others. I certainly have mine, and it involved a lot of very drunk musicians in San Francisco in the early 90s singing along to Best of Both Worlds during a late-night Thanksgiving dinner. Bottles and bottles of red wine were flowing, and somehow Scott Walker was on the stereo. It was kind of right when those Fontana solo albums were reissued, and everybody just sort of turned onto them. I think they were imports even. You know, they weren't even available domestically, but it was this crazy sing-along, and this voice just, I mean, you know, it's the voice. Just can't, you can't believe it when you encounter it.
Yeah, mine was a lot more tame. I was playing video games with a friend, and we were listening to WFMU online in Tustin, California, and I was listening to a lot of Juju at the time, and I was just like, oh my God, because it felt like Scott Walker took it a notch further up than even Juju did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. As you mentioned in your film, Scott Walker, 30th Century Man, Scott was an extremely private figure. How did you gain his trust not only to do the documentary, but to record his recording process for his album, The Drift?
Well, it took a long time. I mean, you know, he took about a decade between records at the time. He was really still a little bit in a wilderness when I heard he was about to do a new record. And having, you know, first fallen for the 60s records and then heard Tilt and then started filling in the gaps between them, it was also cinematic and fascinating. It just became a bit of an obsession, you know, the urge to do a film about him, which we didn't know. Could this be the last time he ever recorded, you know? It was just a slow process of building a team and adding ingredients to the mix that sort of gave, you know, created a world in which I thought he would be comfortable entering. You know, a lot of the collaborators on the film were people he had worked with or who he had admired, you know, from director, cameraman, you know, Grant G, who's a great director in his own right, collaborated with me on the film. He had worked with Scott. Graham Wood from you know, Tomato, the great graphic design legends. He had done some work on some music with when Tilt came out. He did a visual piece to Patriot, so he ended up collaborating with us and creating a lot of visual sequences. And then we got David Bowie to agree to be an exec producer, probably the biggest, most high-profile Scott fan you could have found. And the love and the support was genuine, you know, and it created a nice sort of world in which I think Scott eventually just felt comfortable stepping into.
You mentioned in the film when he feels comfortable, he takes the hat off. How often did you see him take the hat off in the course of making your film?
Never. Never. We weren't in there that long. You know, we were in the studio and that was, you know, he kept it pretty tight.
Yeah.
We rarely got to look under the brim.
Yeah, for the final sit-down interview when you were just trying to clean up any discrepancies, I think his hat was definitely off, but during the recording sessions and most of the time, it was on.
Of course, yeah, yeah. I mean, it's so long ago, I tend to forget that, yeah, that the interview was the thing we did at the very, very end. And actually, yeah, it was off for that, wasn't it? I haven't looked at the film in a long, long time. And we're going to do a tribute screening of it in London in a few weeks. And I may or may not watch it again. I don't know. It was a pretty intense experience. But yeah, and that interview really only took about 45 minutes. But he did wait till the very, very end to let us in there. But it was great. You know, we found our way there through an examination of the work as opposed to the person. And that, I think, was also something he really appreciated.
Yeah, the film a lot reminds me of Andrew Bird's film Fever Year, where it's mostly Andrew Bird playing and then you get a little bit of scenes from his private life, but then that's just too close for him still. I don't know if you've seen that film yet.
I have not, no.
Oh, yeah, it really closely resembles Fever Year. I don't even think it's... So when that film was made, it was made with the understanding it would only be screened in public, and so DVDs and Blu-rays do not exist of that film. It's only was shown in, like,
right,
libraries and museums. Scott got into a career in music fairly early on. He was born in Ohio and recorded his first demo when he was 14. How did Scott get from Ohio to L.A. To do the club scene in the early 60s?
As I recall, it was a traveling family. You know, I believe they moved. You know, I'm going to be a little shaky on the actual mechanics of it, but what I do know is he, at the time, they land in L.A. His father was in the oil industry. They were kind of well off in a way. You know, I mean, I think he had a pretty comfortable upbringing. In L.A., he attended Hollywood High and ended up in a kind of a go-go combo called the Walker Brothers. And Gary was not the original drummer. It was a very large man, of course, named Tiny, who was playing with them. And Gary had been touring with P.J. Proby in England, came back all amped up on the scene in the U.K. in the 60s that he discovered, and had been just hanging out on the strip, seeing these guys called the Walker Brothers, you know, not named Walker, not brothers, and just convinced them to ditch the drummer if he could join, because his dad would finance a trip to London where they could really like hit a really swinging scene. And that's kind of how they ended up in the UK in the mid-60s. But yeah, here in LA, they were just like playing places like, you know, Whiskey A Go-Go and Gazzari's. And yeah, it was, you know, the white go-go boot era. And they were just playing, you know, multiple sets all night, every night, you know, for weeks. And it was just the popular music of the day. They hadn't really recorded at that point.
Well, that's one of the strange and funny things to me as well, is they moved to London to try to find success in that L.A. scene with the go-go boot scene. You had Kim Foley's and others that were still turning out hit singles within that scene, and I don't think Beatlemania had hit that time just yet, or is that right?
It was just on the cusp. I mean, they kind of made a reverse British invasion, you know? You got to remember, Scott would, you know, take his days off and go sit in cinemas and watch Bergman movies. I mean, he was a weirdo, and, you know, he wasn't, like, enamored with what was going on here in L.A., and I think the idea of just being in Europe or as close as he could possibly get to it, I know he said this at some point, you know, he said he thought he would just arrive and he would meet Ingmar Bergman just walking down the street, or Godard would be in a coffee shop on the corner or something. He had this really idealized and fantasized version of what being European was. But then when you see him approach European music, kind of like through Jacques Brel, he does it in this unbelievably florid and over-the-top style that almost becomes the standard for doing those songs. So he was pursuing something by going to the UK. You know, he was following something that he was already being drawn to anyway.
Yeah. Why did the Walker Brothers' successes in England never translate to the United States beyond a couple of singles that charted? In preparing for this interview, I've actually read a piece that said that one time the Walker Brothers had a bigger mailing fan, like a mail list, not an email list, just a list because it's before email, that was bigger than the Beatles.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, if you flip through the papers, like the pop papers of the day, it's Beatles, Stones, Walkers, Beatles, Stones, Walkers. I mean, they were just massive in the UK at that time, just for a very short period. But you got to remember that it was the time of the draft, and if they had toured them back, if they had sent them back to America, they probably would have been drafted.
Oh.
This was 65, right? Mid-60s. So they were afraid of that and kept them in England. Like, the record company would not tour them outside of the UK.
Oh, that makes
They wouldn't
sense.
Send them back to America.
Yeah, because I always thought, I never really had a clear explanation on that, and I always thought it was kind of a distribution issue, like what the Beatles had with Capitol and EMI, where they put out Yesterday and Today in England, and they had the dismembered bodies of babies on it, and then that never really played well in the U.S., and EMI and Capitol weren't talking to each other.
Yeah, that's really the only explanation I've ever heard, is that it actually was, they were afraid that Scott and the boys would get drafted, and they wouldn't be able to, you know, get them back to England, because they were at the height of their success, so they just worked them as much as they could in the UK. That's what I understand.
Huh?
Is the truth?
So the dad that had connections in England and financed a trip, did he also have connections to a record label, or was it, did they have to grind it out through the club scene like other bands did in the day?
God, you're testing my memory here. As I remember it, I think they had actually already hooked up with, I should have done my homework before we talked. They did a single called Love Her.
Okay.
Friedrich Nietzsche, right? He who had worked under Spector. So I believe they had recorded that. And I could be wrong. It may have been recorded in LA, and then it ended up becoming very popular on radio in the UK. I'm not 100% clear on the facts on how they hooked up with the Decca, but that was the record label that ended up taking them on as the Walker Brothers, and you know, they were immediately put into the machine there. I mean, they had great studios. Decca had one of the best echo chambers in all of the UK. It was the same musical director as Dusty Springfield, a man named Ivor Raymond, whose son Simon went on to form was a member of the Cocteau Twins. I don't know if you know, that's an interesting little sidebar. literally one thing after another. I mean, these singles just, they blew up. You know, they had that same kind of wall of sound equivalence. They had Dusty's people giving them that orchestral backing, yet they had this doomy baritone cutting through it all, and there was really nothing like it. And no one that looked like that, too. I mean, you got to remember, this was, you know, the Beatles were on their way to America to do that thing, and these three really good-looking California boys with deep, gorgeous voices pop out of nowhere. I mean, the timing was brilliant on their part.
Yeah, and Scott really didn't do lead vocals. I think John Mouse was doing them until the single "The Sun Ain't Gonna Shine Anymore."
Well, no, it was Love Her.
It was Love Her. Oh, okay.
Because the producer was just like, he doesn't sing low enough. Let's try something else. And they moved Scott into the lead, and they wouldn't let him leave from that moment on.
So. Yeah. So to kind of put some context behind what we're talking about, I'm going to play the Walker Brothers' "Sunny's Isn't Going to Shine Anymore." When we come back, we're going to continue the interview just so we kind of get a frame of reference on what we're talking about. This is the Heather McCoy Show. We'll be right back. And you're tuned into the Heather McCoy Show. That was the Walker Brothers' "Sun Ain't Gonna Shine No More." I'm joined by Stephen Kajak. He's the director of Scott Walker, 30th Century Man. It was released in 2006. Scott Walker passed away last month at the age of 76. Welcome back to the show. In doing research for this interview, I came across a Guardian article about Scott Walker, and the writer wrote, "Imagine Andy Williams converting over to Stockhausen." It's hard to imagine like a teen idol from, like, let's just say Justin Bieber. It's hard to imagine 40 years from now him making records like Scott Walker. I mean, this is a monumental shift that he eventually makes.
It's monumental, but if you look back, you can kind of see the seeds of it all through the solo work. But yeah, what is the most devastating, I think, about losing him is we're not going to see where this journey, kind of musical journey, ends up. I feel like he was just, I mean, he had kind of put this last trilogy of records to bed, and he was very busy at work on something new. But yeah, I mean, there's really no precedent for it. I mean, you know, unless I'm wrong, I mean, you can't imagine the radical shift from something like what we just heard to what you end up with, say, on Bish Bosh, you know, the last studio album.
Yeah.
It's mind-boggling, you know, like exactly, like Bieber all of a sudden turning into like Diamanda Galas or something, like it would never happen. It's really a shocking transformation, but if you're willing to follow it, it's just some of the most thrilling music ever made. It's mental, really. I mean, it's shocking. It's cinematic. It's like sound effects with minimal poetry laid on top, and then he pitches the voice into this almost uncomfortable place because he complained that if he sang in that baritone croon, you'd stop really listening to what he was saying. He really wants you to pay attention to what he's saying.
Yeah.
He's going to make you very uncomfortable in the process doing that.
And we're going to get to Bish Bosh later on in the hour. Talk about Scott's B-side work with the Walker Brothers and how that kind of developed him as a songwriter.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it it's right there in the film, right? He says, you know, if you want to get them, it's every artist's, how you make your money. It's publishing, right? So initially they're interpreting a lot of stuff, but to make the cash, they said, you know, write some songs, we'll put them on the B-sides, and you'll make some money. And he was the one that had the chops, you know, as a writer, it turns out. And yeah, he starts penning some original material, even back with the Walker Brothers. I mean, things like Archangel. It's the architecture of goth, you know? I mean, there's nothing like it. He's inspired by existential cinema. He's got that voice, and he just goes for it. He's got all, that's what he would say to us. He said he had all of these things at his disposal. You know, he could just turn on an orchestra. And for Archangel, I believe they went to, I'm going to forget the name of the actual cathedral. They went to a cathedral in London and just blasted the pipe organ and recorded it. You know, I mean, no one gets to do that these, well, you know, no one really was allowed those extravagances back then. And to indulge his songwriting, he pushed it to the limit, and he followed some very interesting subject matter. It was dark, it was gothic, it was, you know, the tortured dark glasses, the croony thing, the whole image just started to really come to full force at that time, and it really presaged what is to come.
On what would turn out to be the Walker Brothers' final tour, they had Jimi Hendrix as one of their opening acts. Was the fact that Jimi was likely overpowering the Walker Brothers night after night one of the contributing factors to them breaking up soon after that tour?
Well, yeah. I mean, well, it was partly that, and, you know, tastes were changing. And I think, you know, as he wrote more, I'm sure Scott felt like he really just wanted to, embrace his own creativity a little more, and he had a vision for what he wanted to do. But yeah, I mean, his trajectory is interesting in that it's moving right into the late 60s as he's kind of growing in power. Music and tastes and society and culture itself are radically changing. And he doesn't change. He just refuses to change because he's going in one direction where everyone else was, like he says in the film, everyone else was chasing the summer of love. He was kind of going into the heart of European darkness. You know, he really wanted to explore a songcraft. I mean, he was obsessed with Jacques Brel, you know, not the Beat Poets or whatever. It just went into a completely different direction. And it fell out of favor. I mean, his first few solo albums were chart toppers. But by 69, he's gone right after he delivers his masterpiece, you know?
Yeah. The London tabloids were, as you show in the film, the London tabloids were rather treacherous towards Scott and the band during this time. Is this when he started becoming extremely reclusive?
I guess so. I mean, the tabloids are horrible to everybody, though.
That's true.
To them, you know?
Well, they're not. I mean, they're terrible if you're on the public spotlight. But he seems to have reacted in a way where he's just becomes really reclusive and just kind of hides and not.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, we interviewed, you know, for example, Lulu, who's in the film. They were contemporaries at the time, and you know, some people might have the wiring for fame. He just didn't. You know.
Yeah.
And that's what you know. Just I think a lot of the reaction. There was a lot of reaction to that in the later music. You can hear it. I mean, it becomes a terror, you know, for him. In the film, he talks about, you know, the Beatlemania, the Walkermania kind of barrage that hits them, right? The fans, they overturned a van they were in at one point, and just, like, the urge for people to get at them, that kind of thing that was happening in to pop stars at the time, which was a relatively new phenomenon. Nobody was prepared for that. And he certainly wasn't, and it created a retreat reaction, you know. Some people embrace it, some people run from it. He ends up in a monastery studying Gregorian chant, you know, and had to leave that because the fans found out he was there on the Isle of Wight or something.
Oh, wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's in the film. There's a little room you see at the very end of the film is actually the room he stayed in. We filmed out there at the Quar Monastery. Yeah, he takes a bit of a sabbatical and just shows up at the Quar Monastery on the Isle of Wight, and you can just go there and they'll take anybody in. And I believe he, you know, studied chant with the monks and tried to get a little peace away from it all, and was found out, and he had to, you know. But yeah, that was the reaction, you know. And you can hear some of that. You can definitely hear some of that influence, I think, of that kind of chant and that kind of music kind of locked in and kind of found its way into some of the later work too.
How did Scott make the leap from just becoming a solo artist?
The solo record, you know, I'm not 100% clear on the what and why, like how it actually happened, but you know, he was a huge star and wanted to carry on. He had still a great relationship with the record label. This was 67, I believe, is when you get Scott, the first solo record. And he's still, this is the thing, he's still a crooner, right? In the mid to late 60s, he's still interpreting, he's still crooning. He had gotten his hands on Jacques Brel music, the great French singer. And I believe, from what I remember, Scott was one of the first to get his hands on some of those early English translations of Brel's work. The show Jacques Brel is Alive and Well and Living in Paris, I think, is just starting to make its way to Broadway or the West End or something. Like, it's the Western world is starting to discover these songs, and Bowie, of course, would later cover My Death. But Scott really nailed it first, and he ends up that. In the film, you'll hear him say, he says that was the key for him to unlock the way forward. So the solo records, you know, they start with these absolutely shocking versions of Jacques Brel songs mixed with some slightly cheesy, you know, contemporary songs of the day. He's doing some Bacharach, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
And then eventually his own compositions start to thread in. They're fantastic records, right? It's like 67 to 69. Really easy to find. Scott 1, 2, 3, and 4, he numbered them, so it's very easy to find them and put them in order. And it's a magnificent evolution, those four records. They're really, and they sound incredible. Again, it's the Decca Studios, it's the music directors, the orchestras are just, you know, exemplary. Some of the best people working on those records. They sound great, and he's exploring some really cool stuff.
Scott 1 through 3 were successful records in terms of sales, but when he released Scott 4, that record, a record in which entirely consists of his compositions, it failed commercially at the time. How did he respond to that?
I can only imagine. It was devastating. I mean, he puts it out, first of all, he decides he's going to release it under his actual name, Noel Scott Engel. So that might have had to do with some of the confusion, but his theory, I'm just going to quote him, right, is that the third record was actually it's a beautiful record, but he said a lot of it was done in 3/4 time. There's some kind of waltzy odd stuff. It's a really gorgeous record, Scott 3, but he feels like that it was successful in the momentum of Scott 2. Everyone tuned into it and went, oh, what is this? Like, they're starting to lose focus here. They aren't really sure where he's going. So by the time the fourth one came out, they just thought, oh, forget it. We're done. It could have been that. It could have been the change of, you know, that he didn't put it out under his own name. By 69, people are buying different records. Like, there are just other bands that are dominating the charts. And some people tended to look at him as a relic of another time. You know, he could have appeared to some as kind of a schmaltzy crooner. So they might not have bothered to listen to it. An album that's it stands tall today. I mean, it's a towering achievement of songwriting. It's got some of the most magnificent stuff on it. Really a spectacular record. It vanished.
Yeah.
It tanked and it was deleted. You know, Scott 4, really great record.
One of the comparisons in my mind that I always make to Scott Walker is the folk singer Karen Dalton. Both are uniquely, mm-hmm. unquestionably talented, but Scott somehow soldiered on after his commercial disappointments and still found ways to record, even if it wasn't, you know, even if he wasn't going for hit singles anymore, and she never did. So I kind of, everything post Scott 4, I feel like the world is very fortunate to have.
Yeah, well, he wouldn't say so in terms of some of those. I mean, those, like, there were three records. Actually, I got to say, there was one album, a lot of people call it Scott 5, really. It's Till the Band Comes In, which I think 1970. Half of it he wrote, half of it he did not. But there's some really great stuff on that. I mean, those middle period records are really interesting in that they don't get a lot of attention. We tried to put a little bit of a focus on them in the film. Till the Band Comes In kind of fell through the cracks, although it's got some of my favorite Scott tunes on it. You know, Thanks for Chicago, Mr. Jim. I mean, you know, kind of the story of a cowboy hustler and an older man. I mean, he's exploring some really strange and hilarious subject matter on these records, and it's kind of like an what do I have to lose kind of moment. And he did some great stuff.
He's had a couple of those in his career.
Oh yeah. And then there are like the three kind of Countrypolitan records kind of that sit in the middle there, like We Had It All, We Had It All, and then Stretch, you know, his kind of like cowboy mid-70s sort of urban cowboy sort of record, done entirely in the UK, of course. You know, he covers Delta Dawn, Frisco Station. I mean, they're nutty. He said he did them all drunk and he was just working off contracts. But if you go back, I mean, it's like the more those age, after doing the film and I was so saturated with the two sides of the career, I kind of only wanted to listen to those strange little middle records, because they sounded fresh to me all of a sudden, you know, and there's some real joy to be had in those albums.
Are a lot of those in print? Because I know he was really meticulous about not having what he thought was the embarrassing stuff in print.
You can find them. I mean, they're out there. I haven't really looked for a while. I know Stretch and We Had It All, I believe, are like, you can get it on one CD, you know, like 2-for-1 kind of packaging.
Yeah, yeah.
If you have a real king for Scott Walker, you have to have those records. That's all there is to it. It's just really good stuff.
Yeah, I'll have to go find those and put those on my list. Just to kind of catch everybody up on let's listening, we're talking about Scott Walker, the musician, not the reactionary governor of Wisconsin. My guest is Stephen Kayak. He directed a film in 2006 called Scott Walker, 30th Century Man, and we're kind of dedicating this hour to his life and work since he passed away recently. We're going to hear this period of Scott Walker. I'm going to play something called The Old Man Is Back Again from Scott 4. And then we're going to be right back after this song. And this is the Heather McCoy Show.
I've seen a hand. I've seen a vision. It was reaching through the clouds to risk a dream. A shadow crossed the sky and it crushed it to the ground just like a beast. The old man's back again. The old man's back again.
seen a woman standing in the snow. She was silent as she watched them take her man. Teardrops burned her cheeks, for she thought she'd heard the shadow had left this land. The old man's back again. The crowds just gathered, their faces turned away, and they queue all day like dragons of disgust. Older women whispering, wondering just what these young hotheads want of us. And Andre V, he cries, with eyes that ring like chimes. His anti-worlds go spinning through his head. He burns them in his dreams. For half awake, they may as well be dead. The old man's back again. I see he's back again. A soldier, he's standing in the rain. For him there's no old man to walk behind. Devoured by his pain, bewildered by the faces who pass him by. He'd like another name, the one he's got's a curse. These people cry. Why can't they understand? His mother called him Ivan, then she died. The old man's back again.
And we're back on the Heather McCoy Show. We're doing an all Scott Walker tribute hour. Scott's lyrics are notoriously vague. That one feels has a little bit more, I can put a little more context to it. Was there a reason why he wrote really vague poetry where there's very vivid scenes, but the rest you kind of have to figure out on yourself?
I can't really answer that. I mean, that's, you know, why that's an impossible question to answer. I mean, you know, ask a poet why he does what he does, why
yeah.
he puts those words on that page, you know. I do know, well, one thing he did say in the film in relation to some of the later work is he was never fond of, like, the so-called protest singer, you know, the guy with the guitar preaching at you. He's just, you know, he wants to create, you know, narratives and mystery, and let you find your way through that, I think, is more of, you know, where he's going. You know, something that can open up discussion and interpretation, and let the shock of that space kind of between the words and the music create something new, you know, as opposed to being direct. I mean, that's the thing, is the more you get into him and turn on to what he's doing, if you are any kind of a creative person, it's going to push the bar higher and higher. And really, you know, there are fantastic lessons to learn in his work, I think, because very few people have that integrity and that kind of have kind of reached that place in their art. I mean, if you really, really get into that and listen to what he's up to, I mean, it's hard to like a lot of other stuff because everything else sounds like rubbish, to be honest, after you've gone there.
Yeah, and then early on, even with you, when he was with the Walker Brothers, he in your film, he's has a clip of him saying basically, like, I really don't care about getting rich. It's not about getting rich. It's about making art, which is something that a lot of rock stars, you know, pay lip service to, but they don't really mean it. Scott meant it.
No, he meant it. He really did. You know, if you knew how he lived, and it just, and the kind of music he made, there was no, once he decided to just do it his way, there's no other explanation. You know, it's clearly not a cash grab by any stretch of the imagination.
And this is a perception on my part, but you were actually filming it with him. When you were like, as a viewer that has no context about how the scenes are filmed or anything like that, Scott comes across as somebody that is kind of living off his loyalties, and he's free to do what he wants now. Was that really the case, or was he still cast-strapped even though he was making really extravagant recordings still?
You know what? I don't really know. I mean, there is a part of the life that is just, you know, not accessible to us. But, you know, I'm sure the royalties were significant, especially in the UK. Those songs are always, like, the Walker Brothers were just so much a part of the culture. I mean, it's classic music the way the Stones or the Beatles was. And it's like, you're always going to hear those songs. You know, was there family money? I mean, from a father who had a, you know, was in the oil industry. I mean, who knows, really? I can't imagine he did not live extravagantly. I mean, as far as we knew, he's always seen around London riding his bike, you know, go to the cinema on his bicycle. There's a little anecdote in the film where, like, you know, he spot him on his, like, what's his name? Radiohead's producer.
Niall
sees him, spots him, you know, on the way to the studio as they're recording OK Computer. They're like, I think I just saw Scott Walker on his bike, you know? And it turns out they were all recording at the same studio. And he was just like, my God, he's on his bicycle on the way to the studio. But yeah, I mean, the thing is, what you have to remember is that he's so revered that when a record label decides to commit to him, they're going to let him do whatever the hell he wants, you know? And that's what he founded in 4AD. By the time he lands on 4AD, they were just so delighted to have him. It was just like, they also were not that concerned with the numbers. It was just like, my God, we can let Scott Walker do whatever he wants. Let's give him the freedom to do that. They were so supportive of his mission. Just that there would be another Scott Walker record in the world, I think, was enough for them.
Yeah, that's what I was going to mention about that. Post-70s, the world kind of opened up for artists to actually do what they want. You had a proliferation of, like, record labels in that time due to the DIY movement that put out punk and post-punk and hip-hop releases. 4AD mm-hmm. put out the Pixies and a bunch, Blonde Redhead and a number of indie acts. So they had the financial wherewithal to support that, because they have a pretty deep back catalog of that kind of stuff that's kind of ingrained into indie culture as a backstop.
Oh yeah, and I mean, by that point, you know, they're part of the Beggars Group, very successful record group in general. But yeah, 4AD's, you know, legacy goes back to early Bauhaus, Cocteau Twins, Dead Can Dance. You know, Brendan Perry would, you know, admit to a great reverence for Scott. You can hear a lot of Scott in that work. He was a real hero to a lot of those people, so it really made a lot of sense. And I mean, you can't underestimate the effect that Julian Cope had on kind of reinvigorating Scott's legacy with that kind of post-punk crowd. I'm going to get the date wrong, but he put out his own compilation of Scott's songs called Fire Escape in the Sky, kind of like late 80s. I can't remember the exact date, but, you know, Julian Cope, the great singer, songwriter, mystic character, put his own compilation out of Scott's music, and it was pulled from all the 60s records, and he only released the songs that Scott himself had written. So it put a new focus on him as a writer, as opposed to, like, that schmaltzy crooner. And it started to, you know, because his albums were out of print, they were forgotten, they weren't, you know, looked upon favorably. And it's most of that generation of people that I have in the film, like people like Jarvis Cocker, The guy, you know, Damon Albarn, Goldfrapp, all these people like started seeing, like listening to this record, and it, Mark Almond, everybody started to reassess him and kind of put a new focus on him and his importance in British music.
Why did he never tour again?
Well, he, you know, listened to those records. He said he couldn't drag those orchestras around, you know, especially the later work. Forget about it, you know?
Yeah.
And to him, like the way he explains it in the film is it takes so much for him to get across the kind of landscape of the song vocally that he said, but if he had to do it every night, it would kill him.
Yeah.
You know, he can barely get it done and then put the record to bed and move on. You know, yeah, I don't know. I mean, that was part of it. I'm sure if he wanted to, he could have figured out a way to do it. But he never wanted to. He never wanted to.
Did you did the film in 2006. Did you keep up with him after the documentary was over?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, not him himself. You don't keep up with him. I mean, he keeps himself, you know, behind several layers of protection. No, but his management, these lovely people that, you know, I initially reached out to when I was starting the process. It's a husband and wife. You know, they don't really handle many people. He was kind of their main focus for years and years. Just, they became like family, really. I mean, they really appreciated the work. I think the film did a lot of good, and came at a great time when he was kind of starting to develop more creative momentum. And, it took us so damn long to do it. We're like all in the trenches together in a way. And, I kept up via them. So, you know, you felt close to it, and it was just always exciting to see where he would go next. Which is, again, one of the crushing disappointments of this is just, I know he was working on something new. You pick up the book Sundog, he just released a book of lyrics, and the later ones are new pieces. There are new songs that were being written. So we have the lyrics, but we don't have the sounds that go with them, which really sucks.
That does suck. You mentioned creative momentum because he doesn't release, I think throughout the 70s, so the 80s he released one album, the 90s he released one album, and then from 2006 to his passing away, he did three. He did The Drift, Bish Bosh, and his combo work with the heavy metal band Sun O. Was that what was the creative momentum, why he was so prolific for Scott Walker later on in his life?
Yeah, I mean, there was also commissions from he did some pieces for Dance and Who Shall Go to the Ball, and What Shall Go to the Ball is the actual full title of an EP, a very noisy instrumental work. He started doing film scores, working with Brady Corbett on his two movies. That's momentum. I mean, some people would, you know, still think it was slow, but for him, he was cranking them out. It just felt like he was entering a really fertile period. The collaboration with Sun O, by the way, the album Soused.
Yeah.
One of the most awesome, hard, heavy, cool records ever made, I think. Really great.
Yeah. So we're coming up against the clock. I'm going to let you go because I'm going to close out with a song from Bish Bosh, which is 9 minutes long, and I don't want you to hang on the phone for 9 minutes. Is there anything else you want to leave our listeners with?
No, just play some Scott Walker. That'll do it.
That will do it. Okay. That's awesome. Thanks for joining us, by the way. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. My guest has been Stephen Kayak. He's the director of Scott Walker, 30th Century Man. You can find the movie. I know it's on Apple's store. Where else can you find the movie still? Is it still in print on DVD or Blu-ray?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Sure, out there somewhere.
Yeah, just search engine that, and it's a really unique look into a life of a creative genius. Thanks for joining us on the show, and this is Episodics from Scott Walker, and I'll be back to wrap things up in about 9 minutes. Thanks for listening to the Adam McCoy Show.
neighbor was frightened by Hawaiians. When all the veins ran out, when too much bone structure went missing, she thumbed the galleon cock of Fuego, forsook the eyebrows climbing into greasy black hairline. Narcotic legs yanked down around melanoma ankles, their putrid petals dropping, erasing the white shoe, like a face being eaten by a jungle. Slabs of steam tables whiffing of onions and roses, haunted jacuzzis churning. All night the native bots squealing B-flat, like choirs of pigs seeking revenge for stolen innocence. Blippers fast brown, that's how we cop the final. Reach this city without sound. Everywhere you turn, bunkers of rubber hoses pronging up off the city's floor. Check time, clam bake out. Don't step on that rotting tartar. Just might bust your conk, might lay your racket. Early black hickaroo, it's tense, tense, unseen through pound for pound. All the people on the corners pushing each other around, humping like buggers, touching like muggers, pushing each other around. Oedipal Serenazoot, Saloshing Carrot, ballooning down the street. 1,000 kilo simping, 40 stone sand, tips his sky piece, come to weigh me up. But I'm toned, got bucket, ground drippers ready to trill it. Laying down, I talk to the bricks. Let's add a little shade. Try something apart from the hog's head. While Pope Julius affects his red slippers, let Michelangelo tiptoe around in his dark skin boots. The powder on a chalky bosom rises and hangs in the air. Clouds crawling through protracted blue like souls of insects. One threshing haze, the scent of spider lilies.
Tempe's begged decapitation. Rotates to the ocean floor. Its nostrils are twitching and sniffing. Your glasses on, Gate. There's some man's glimmers, a Canon V8. Twisters in the slammer, frisking the whiskers till Peola dims. On the chime of black, it's tense, tense, unseen through pound for pound. Scratch the Jesus on the corner, pushing each other around. Shoving like sluggers, touching like muggers, pushing each other around. Snapping their caps, sliding their gems. Lamping the breeze, draping the trees. Whoops, pardon the emperor. Let's just shift you over here. Sorry, I'm so clumsy. Take that accidentally in the bollocks for a start. Seven brides jumped in port, reached the city without sound. Copacetic on the corners, pushing each other around. Everybody on the corners, pushing each other around. Joe below, hinkty dinkty. Slip the pounders, fuse and tooth. Boot me down in the land of darkness. Sweet Leilani, heavenly flower.
This is the Heather McCoy Show. That was Scott Walker from his album Bish Bosh from 2012, Episodics. I want to thank again Stephen Kayak, director of Scott Walker 30th Century Man, released in 2006, for joining me for the hour to talk about Scott's work and his life. It's been really cathartic for me as a fan. I'm a huge, huge fan of Scott Walker. He's influenced a lot of what I perceive in the world nowadays. Coming up next is Between the Covers. Then we have music at noon. PA's shows start again at 4 p.m. with a replay of Democracy Now! Thanks for tuning in to KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM, community radio supported by you, the people. This is the Heather McCoy Show. We're in pledge drive for the next 2 weeks. Next week's going to be a re-airing of my interview with... Johan Curry about Lost Connections. That's going to be the pledge premium for that thing. Please help support the show for next week. And I think I'm off the next week for a special edition of Press Watch. But KBOO Fun Drive is coming up next week. I want to just reiterate that. If you want to hear me actually play music, there's Smoke Signals from the Speakeasy from 3 a.m. to 6 a.m. every other Saturday night. And I have one coming up, or Saturday morning. I've got one coming up this week. Bye for now.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 11 o'clock. Coming up next is Between the Covers. David Naiman talks to Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award finalist Christine Schutt about her latest story collection, Pure Hollywood. And 11:30, Black Book Talk co-host Emma Jackson Ford, O.B. Hill, and Patricia Wells discuss what's on their bookshelves this month. Listeners are invited to call in and share their current reads. All of these KBOO programming are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio starts our spring membership drive starting April 8th. And before that, we'd love to hear from you directly about why you support KBOO. My name is Mo, a KBOO volunteer, and I support KBOO because I grew up with KBOO. It's part of my life, and I feel having a community outlet like KBOO is so important because it creates a more vibrant community in a place where different ideas are not only heard, but honored. Why do you support KBOO? Call us and let us know at 503-231-8032, extension 302, to leave a voicemail, or tag us with your support on your social media posts. And thank you for supporting KBOO.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland.